Let's get this last tie piled on the track. There.
Oh, boy. Now we'll see a wreck that's really a wreck.
And how?
The National Broadcasting Company presents The National Hour. This is a mirror of public opinion, reflecting what America and the world are thinking, planning, doing. This is today's interpretation of the problems and the newsworthy milestones that we must reach and pass on the road to peace and reconstruction. Today, March 10th, 1946, we present the 17th in the distinguished new NBC series, The National Hour. Subject for today.
Our national shame, the problem of post-war youth.
This is Robert St. John. Waiting with me here in New York to share in our report to you today is a 12-year-old boy, a product of the streets of New York, come to tell us the story of the reform in his neighborhood. And we will also hear from Judge Anna M. Cross of the New York Magistrates Court, one of the nation's outstanding authorities on juvenile delinquency.
This is Robert McCormick reporting from Washington. Also in Washington, ready to draw upon his personal experience with our youth problem, is Patrolman Oliver C. Cowan of the 13th Washington Police Precinct. He has won considerable attention for his unique method of handling juvenile gangs right here in the nation's capital. We are standing by.
We begin today in the ugly slums of one of our great cities. It's a hot summer afternoon, one of those sticky evenings when nothing seems to stir. In an adjoining park, there's a dance going on. A few shadowy forms suddenly leave the dance and walk toward the street. Their friends know them as the Chancellor Gang.
Where'd you see him? Just across the street. Say anything to you?
He didn't see me.
Okay. We'll take care of him.
There they are. Across the road under the streetlight.
All right. You guys stay here and cover me.
Okay.
Silently on the other side of the street stands a rival gang, the Copians. Deliberately, the Chancellor leader walks toward them. All of a sudden, without any warning, a Copian throws a milk bottle.
That does it! Light him up, Chancellor!
Toll, three bullets in the body of the leader of the Chancellors. A 15-year-old boy dying from five police bullets, a revolver in his hand. Four other children bleeding on the pavement. Two with their jaws shattered by guns fired point blank. A police officer swaying, his stomach full of slugs. This story that you've just heard is not a figment of some writer's imagination. It actually happened in these United States. It's a horrible example of the problem with which we are confronted today, the problem of our next generation.
And if you think of this problem existing only among big city children combined in gangs pouring out of crowded tenements into dirty streets, think again. For it's a problem that crops up with a thousand variations in the fresh air of our country towns, too. And it cuts across social barriers like a sharp knife.
Juvenile delinquency, we like to call it, and let it go at that. But if you examine that stock phrase closely, it hardly takes in the millions of our youth who never get to court, but who are a problem to themselves, their families, and the nation just the same. A problem bad enough before the war, viciously accelerated during the war, and today exploding in our faces all over the nation. Because we will have gained nothing if we have won the war but to lose our children, let's take a good hard look at the facts.
I took a good hard look at the facts they gave me down here in Washington, St. John. I went over to J. Edgar Hoover's office at the FBI, and what I learned, made my hair stand on end.
Listen, if America has a crime wave this year, as much as we hate to say it, we'll have to place a large part of the blame right at the feet of our juveniles. Just consider this. More 17-year-old boys and girls are arrested than any other age group in the country. Take girls alone. In the past 6 years, the arrests of girls under 18 has increased 198%. Raise the age limit a little. Make it under 21. In this group of children under 21, we find 15% of all our murderers, more than a third of all our robbers and thieves, more than a half of all our burglars, more than a quarter of all our arsonists, and almost two-thirds of all our car thieves.
What do you think of that?
What does America think? That's the question. When you consider again that these figures barely represent a small part of our youngsters who are acting up, one point is clear. Whether we realize it or not, we are today facing a serious post-war crop of juvenile misconduct. And the prospect of moral and social waste, compared to which the staggering material waste of the war is as nothing.
Mr. St. John, I'm a father. I have a son, 15 years old. Naturally, I'm disturbed by what you say, but I'm also a little bit confused. My son gets into scrapes now and then. Any normal child does. I don't quite understand what you mean.
Well, Dad, what we mean is the kind of conduct above and beyond what we all know as boyish pranks. Hang on now, and we'll show you what we mean. Recently, outside of public school 173 here in Brooklyn,
nobody.
Okay, we can get in this window. Come on.
Okay.
Gee, this is Miss McGuire's room.
And I don't like Miss McGuire.
I mean, neither. She gave me an F in geography last month.
Then here's where we fix Miss McGuire.
Yeah.
Now, here goes the globe of the world.
Here goes the old hen's table.
Yeah. Now, watch your curve with this ink bottle. Right at the blackboard.
Beautiful. Look out, I'm going to tip over our desk.
Now, give me that knife. Watch the wall map. Look, no more Europe.
And this is what the janitor found when he arrived next morning. Windows shattered, bulbs smashed, walls smeared, desks ripped apart, 21 classrooms in shambles. Damage, $5,000. Nine-year-old kids who said they were just having a little fun.
And along the railroad tracks that parallel the eastern coast...
That's a 1022 now. Quick, let's get this last tie piled up on the track.
Yeah. There. Oh, boy. Now we'll see a wreck that's really a wreck.
And how?
In 1 week, the FBI reported catching several 9 to 14-year-old boys trying to derail four different trains in Maryland, Pennsylvania, and New York. One pair was so terribly successful that they derailed three tank cars, which caught fire, burned down three houses, and added up to $123,000 worth of damage.
A truly sad toll of the war itself for the girls. Girls that the boys used to call khaki wackies, cuddle bunnies, victory girls. Girls who followed the bright lights to the big cities and generally ended up...
There now, Helen. Pull yourself together. Tell me, where did you come from?
A small town down south in Kentucky. My father's a tenant farmer.
Why did you come here to Chicago?
Well, all the boys were gone and everything. There wasn't anything to do. I wanted some excitement. I wanted to be a model.
And
I wasn't good enough, I guess. my money give out. I had to take something. I got a job as an usher at the palace.
And then what happened?
Well, I began to meet a lot of fellas. They took me on dates and everything.
Yes, and then?
Well, Bill, he said he was going to marry me, but he went away sudden-like. Oh, I'm so ashamed.
Could you go back home, dear? We'd be glad to contact your parents.
Oh, no, no, please. There's no future for me there, either.
You can multiply that story many times.
But, St. John, one of our biggest youth problems has nothing to do with juvenile delinquency, at least not yet. It's the problem posed by the thousands of teenage children who gave up school to go into lucrative war jobs and now, with their jobs gone, are just hanging around, poorly equipped for the future, dissatisfied and unhappy, drifting toward disaster.
Listen, I made $62.50 a week at the shipyard, didn't I? Well, why should I go to work 10 hours a day as a delivery boy for 20 measly bucks a week? Me, 16 years old. Who do they think they're kidding?
Ask them why they don't go back to school.
School? You mean go back there and sit with your hands folded all day after having the time of your life? Jeepers, don't be a drip.
There were 2 million more 14 to 18-year-olds employed during the war years than would have been employed normally. No one can say how many have returned to school or found other jobs. But someone who studied this problem said,
the situation is heading up into something like it was in the Depression years. The fascists, remember, found their early support from just such groups of unemployed, frustrated youth.
But why? Why do we have all this?
There is no one cause for the youth problem today that we face. Everything seems to enter into it. The family, which determines the kind of conscience the child develops. The school, which may fail to meet his needs. The community, which may not answer his emotional and social requirements. In fact, you can, if you choose, carry it all the way back to the organization of society itself and call it economic insecurity. To all this, the war added new hazards. Uprooted families, migration, overcrowding, insecure home life, irregular school attendance, child labor, lack of wholesome recreation. But whatever the causes, the important thing is, what are we doing to save this generation?
Well, I, for one, would certainly like to know.
Then listen. Late one Saturday night in Phoenix, Arizona, Judge Harold Schofield, just recently appointed to the bench of a juvenile court, suddenly called together the police, the probation detail, and the sheriff's deputies, 40 of them in all.
All right, gentlemen. All right. You might be wondering why I called you in tonight. Well, this report of the National Probation Council is reason enough. It lists Phoenix, our city, as showing an increase of 77% in juvenile delinquency, the highest in the country. Tonight, I want you men to delve into every nook and cranny of this city. I want you to bring into me every child under 16 years of age that you find out in the streets or in a public place not accompanied by an adult. Okay, go ahead.
That was 11 o'clock. By midnight, the posse was back with the hall, half a hundred juveniles from 15 on down. Then the judge issued another order.
Now I want you to find, go out and bring them in if you have to, the parents of each and every one of these children.
Some parents came on the run. Some had to be found at bars and movie houses. Now the court was jammed.
Folks! 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 I got you here to look at your children. Most of you have splendid children here. A child you have a right to be proud of. But how long will they stay that way? Out on the streets, unescorted, this late at night? Day in and day out, my court is filled with children no better or worse than yours, who have committed crimes. Do you want your child to be one of them?
Until 4 a.m., the judge spoke with each child's parents individually. 10 nights later, the police in a similar roundup could find only one child out alone, and that was a special case. Afterward, Phoenix imposed a strict curfew law, making the parents of children found loitering after 9 o'clock in the evening subject to fines up to $300 and a 6-month jail sentence for the parents. Well, that's the way one city went at it. Other cities tackled the problem in different ways. Take Chicago. A few years ago, in the slums back of Chicago's smelly stockyards, there was hate everywhere and hoodlumism, a community torn by rival dissensions which sent a new crop of children to jail every year. But then something happened.
We formed the Back of the Yards Neighborhood Council. Our motto, the other guy's okay when you get to know him. We mixed the works. CIO, businessmen, Lutherans, Catholics, Jews, Republicans, and Democrats, and started cleaning up the joint. We leased a recreation area. We sent 300 kids to summer camps. Fixed it up for school kids to get free milk and hot sandwiches, just from everybody pitching in and working together. During the war, you didn't see no increase in juvenile delinquency back of the yards.
Down here in the nation's capital, one of our police officers, Patrolman Oliver A. Cowan of the 13th Precinct, an unruly, squalid area once known as Cowtown, Patrolman Cowan worked out his own answer to this problem as he pounded his beat. And Patrolman Cowan is here with me now to tell us about it.
Our project began one evening in October 1942 when I caught four young boys breaking street lights. They expected to be taken to the police station. Instead, we all sat down on the curb and had a long talk. From that talk came the Junior Police and Citizen Corps. The Corps now has an enrollment of about 10,000 youngsters. We did not break up the gangs of children prowling the streets. We used them. We molded them into the Corps, gave them democracy and work to do. The result is they are not gangs of toughies, but worthy citizens with dignity, responsibility, prestige, and self-respect. One boy, for example, was proud of his reputation as the best smasher of streetlights in his neighborhood. He joined the Corps, and we made him commissioner of streetlights. Before the appointment, we couldn't keep lights going in the boy's neighborhood. Now we rarely have a broken bulb. These gangs elect their own mayor and other officers. They hold weekly meetings, have special programs of all kinds. They have something to live for, and areas once soaked with petty crime and rowdyism are now clear and wholesome environment for our youth.
Thank you, Patrolman Cowan.
Another one-man campaign against delinquency is underway in Des Moines, Iowa. A troubled parent sought out the pastor of her church.
I tell you, Pastor, I don't know what to do with the boy. I never know where he and his pal go at night.
I'm beginning to think that maybe the church better go into the entertainment business.
What's that, Pastor?
You send the boy in to see me, Mrs. Curley.
But gosh, Pastor, I go to church on Sunday.
I know that, Billy. This is going to be different.
Different?
That's right. We're just going to sing, dance, eat, and play 3 nights a week right here in the church basement.
Gee, say, that's swell. You mean... Oh.
What's the matter, Billy?
I'm sorry, Pastor. You see, my best pal, he doesn't belong to this church.
Billy, from now on, this church basement's going to be open to any child. No questions asked.
Gosh, Pastor, you're an all right guy.
In New York City, an organization known as Youth Builders Incorporated is at work in the schools. Under this program, specially trained teachers are freed by the schools to work directly with volunteer students to organize discussion groups to talk out and act on their ideas for the improvement of their communities. Gang organizations, which once disrupted school and neighborhood, have been turned to worthwhile ends. This unique transformation is represented for us here today by, well, by a boy whose name it's probably best that we don't tell you. We also prefer to leave the school unnamed. Well, son, what's the pitch?
First off, Youthfield has made a survey of the places you could go after school. Then to get everybody to take part in games and projects. We had a publicity campaign. We distributed posters and booklets throughout our own school and around the stores in the neighborhood. We also gave them to the parents so that we could clear up juvenile delinquency in our school and in the whole neighborhood. Our first job was to get the kids off the streets. Then we had to explain that they had to play together in order to get along. There were some children who wrote things about different races and religions on the walls of our school. But they soon learned, if you want to get any place in this world, and so that we don't have war all the time, you've got to work with everybody.
A city in Illinois was aroused to action by the children themselves. It all happened when a letter appeared in the paper.
And so all we do is hang around, nowhere to go. Now the city's talking about building a new road. What does that mean to us? Can we play on the road? What we want to know is, where do we kids come in?
Come in, Joseph Pagetta, age 11, and gang. Well.
Say, Mrs. Wilson, this is Jim Fowler of the Dad's Club.
Oh, yes, Mr. Fowler.
Did you read that letter in the paper?
Yeah, I did. Yes, and it certainly made me sit up and think.
Well, I'm just wondering, do you suppose we might call a joint meeting, your parent-teachers association and my club, and invite these kids and see what we can do?
Oh, it's a splendid idea. I'll contact all the members.
Why not, kids? Just a minute.
Let's get down to brass tacks. Now, just what do you want?
If you'd just give us a hangout, maybe things would be different.
All right, now look, now, wait a minute. It isn't that we wouldn't like to give you a place to play. It's just that the town doesn't have the kind of facilities you speak of. Now, if you kids could find some kind of a place yourselves, we grown-ups would be glad to help you.
Hey, did you find anything?
Not a thing. Covered the whole east side, too.
Hey, fellas, I got
what?
It. A warehouse down on Vine Street.
Yes.
Yeah, not even a rat in it. Come on, I'll show it to you.
Oh, boy.
Turn an unused warehouse over to a bunch of teenage kids in slacks and jeans. Let them give it a bath and a coat of paint. Lend them some skilled help. Chip in some money. And you can't fail to come out with a place to play. All over the land, youth centers, some started by the children themselves, some co-sponsored by the Y, church groups, school authorities, organizations like, well, like the Kiwanis, the American Legion, welfare agencies, recreation departments, they've burst like blossoms of hope, answering the juveniles' crying need for something to do, somewhere to go. Have they proved successful? Well, let's see.
Here in Fairfield, California, juvenile delinquency dropped 100%.
Here in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, you see less and less kids on the street at night or in public dance halls, and less drinking among high school students.
However, all these heroic efforts are not enough. Juvenile delinquency and youth problems are still on the march. To make matters worse, much of the federal and state aid that supported youth activities has been or is now being withdrawn. Then, too, the interest of many individuals and organizations has suddenly slackened with the war's end. Thus, the problem remains a challenge to every citizen in the United States.
One person who has been meeting that challenge day in and day out is Judge Anna M. Cross of the New York City Magistrate Court and chairman of the Youth Conservation Committee of the General Federation of Women's Clubs. She is here now, ready to give us the benefit of her many years of firsthand experience in working toward the problem's solution. What do you think, Judge Cross?
The problems you have just heard presented here are unfortunately true.
My experience as a judge facing these problems daily has convinced me that the best job done at the point of arrest in court will not stem the tide of crime and delinquency. It's like closing the stable when the horse has been stolen. Crime and delinquency are the symptoms of a contagious disease to which human beings succumb in communities where the soil is fertile for the breeding of the germs. We haven't yet found an antitoxin for crime and delinquency. We cannot vaccinate against it, but we do know that slums produce the major crop of delinquents. It's unrealistic to believe that the responsibility can be placed upon parents alone. Parents, at best, are but the older victims of the same disease: bad housing, poor schools, poor health facilities, lack of employment, lack of an adequate outlet for leisure hours make for crime and delinquency. When the home, the church, and the school fail, no policeman, no matter what tools are at his command, no judge, no matter how socially minded and understanding, no parole or probation officer, no reformatory, and certainly no prison can succeed. For that reason, I, together with 2.5 million women of the General Federation of Women's Clubs, have undertaken an overall educational preventive program by building up an awareness in the communities, by developing real cooperation, calling in young people themselves to assume responsibility and learn the process of democracy by actual participation in community life through the home, school, the church, and through the community. Our young people may be vulnerable, but they are not expendable. Our program of youth conservation will help young people to help themselves. Through our 16,500 clubs, we have launched our youth conservation program to arouse the communities to the dangers ahead, to get all organizations and individuals in the community to combine and plan for better Americans, for a better America, and thus stop the ever-increasing shocking human wastage as represented by the daily crop of young criminals. With such a program of youth conservation, we can hope to reduce juvenile delinquency and crime to its irreducible minimum.
Thank you, Judge Cross.
The problem of post-war youth has been the subject of our documentary, and this is what we have learned.
That the problem of youth has been considerably accentuated by the war and by what's followed. That young people who left school and were employed in the war effort at high wages are the unknowns in this situation. That we face a real wave of juvenile crime in 1946 if the present rate of arrests continues. That this situation stems from many causes which must be corrected. And that while much is being done, it will take the integrated efforts of all, individual, home, school, church, community, and government, if the tide is to be stemmed.
On this subject, then, our documentary is ended.
But this is Robert St. John inviting you to listen next week when our subject will be The Little Man in Business. Does he face success or failure?
This has been The National Hour. From our studios in New York and Washington, the National Broadcasting Company has presented the 17th in a new series on current national problems and affairs. Speakers were Patrolman Oliver Cowan of Washington, D.C., and Magistrate Anna M. Cross of New York City. Robert St. John was your narrator, with Robert McCormick reporting from Washington. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.